In fact, the situation was not quite as clear-cut as this, even by 1980. And since then, it has become much more controversial. Already in the 1960s and 1970s, the work of historical demographers, and in particular John Haynau, Peter Laslett, Tony Wrigley, and Roger Schofield, and Richard Smith, was showing that many of the most unusual structural features of the Northwest European family and marriage patterns were very old, variously dated back to the start of the 16th century or several centuries earlier. It was now clear that most people in Northwestern Europe, and particularly England, had married at a relatively late age, or not at all, and that married children had lived apart from their parents in small households. There was little evidence in the newly discovered listings of inhabitants, and the evidence beginning to emerge from parish register reconstitutions that there had been a structural transformation in the demographic and marital patterns in the 16th, 17th and or early 18th centuries. Some of the main characteristics of this pattern, enduring from the 16th to the 19th centuries, were specified by Peter Laslett in 1977 in the day in his book on The World We Have Lost. These included the nuclear family form, the late age at marriage, a small gap between age gap between spouses, and, quote, marriage tending towards the companionate, as Laslett put it, and the presence of large numbers of servants. Thus, Laslett suggested that the pattern of family and marriage was basically, quote, the same in the 1550s as it was in the 1820s, end of quote. Largely on the basis of work by Richard Smith, he suggested that this pattern probably went back to the 14th century at least. If these demographic parameters had changed little, Laslett inferred, quote, that Western marriage has always tended to be companionate, end of quote. But he admitted that, quote, only the attitudinal or ideological evidence we need so much to discover could vindicate the claim, end of quote. It was during the 1980s that such evidence began to be published. The orthodox position on sentiment was challenged in an article in 1978, which I wrote as a review of Lawrence Stone's book. But it was only in the 1980s that convincing evidence was produced to show that the predictions of the capitalist revolution model were totally wrong. Some of the major works were written by historians, others by anthropologists and sociologists. We may very briefly summarize a number of the landmarks in this surprisingly rapid overturning of a whole school of thought. The anthropologist Jacqueline Sarsby examined the development of romantic love in England using literary, autobiographical, and local materials. Her historical chapters flatly contradict the developmental story as embodied in the Rise of Sentiment School. Ferdinand Mount considered the evidence without a pre-commitment to a belief in the capitalist and other revolutions, which should have caused a late invention of love, and his work supports Sarsby's. Through an examination of a wide variety of sources dating back to Anglo-Saxon England, he suggests that, quote, most of what has been written until recently about the family in times past must now be dismissed or questioned, end of quote. He finds strong evidence for the romantic love complex as far back as the historical records extend. On a related topic, Linda Pollock found that the theory of the invention of parental love in the 18th century was equally questionable in her book Forgotten Children. Finally, among those who were not full-time historians, the anthropologist Jack Goody argued that the basic structural shape of modern marriage had been attained in England by the 11th century at the latest, and in all probability between the 4th and 9th centuries. The emphasis on the conjugal pair, on consent, a high status for women, and many of the other preconditions for the romantic love complex were already present in late Anglo-Saxon England. Goody argues that the love match, quote, was encouraged by the church's insistence on consent and affection in the early Middle Ages. This institution in essence owes, quote, this is Goody, little to the later transformations of feudalism, mercantile capitalism, and industrial society, Hollywood, or the Germanic tradition. End of quote. These views are now supported by a number of full-time historians who have come to the same conclusion. In a collection of essays on marriage in England, edited by Brian Outhwaite, the contributors challenge the orthodoxy. Christopher Brooke shows how important consent and affection was in medieval marriage. Martin Ingram shows the presence of love in ecclesiastical court records from the 16th century. And Kathleen Davis shows that the ideals of family life changed very, very little as between the 15th and 17th centuries. In one of the first syntheses of the new historical research on early modern England, Keith Wrightson devotes 2 chapters to the family, drawing on a very wide range of published and unpublished sources. He concludes that, quote, concludes that below the level of the aristocracy, gentry, and urban elite, quote, there is no doubt whatever that the initiative in selecting a spouse already lay with the young people concerned, end of quote, in the period between 1580 and 1680. In the motivation of those getting married, he can discern no significant shift in this period. Thus he concludes that, quote, there is little reason to follow Professor Stone in regarding the rise of the companionate marriage as a new phenomenon of the later 17th and 18th centuries. It seems to have been already well established. A particularly interesting study on the English family, 1450 to 1700, by Ralph Holbrook, covers the central period of the supposed birth of the modern world of capitalism and individualism. It is exclusively devoted to the family and marriage, and heavily based on the excellent church court records, which are among the best sources for the study of marital sentiment and behaviour. A whole section in the book, drawing on many sources, shows the importance of love in marriage. On the question of a revolutionary change in the marital and family pattern in this period, Holbrooke is unequivocal. Quote, "Between the 15th and 18th centuries, there was little change in familial forms and functions." End of quote. His picture is one of continuity in a system based on personal choice and a mixture of love and economic consideration from the 15th century onwards. This view is also the one which I have argued for using a number of different sources over the period 1300 to 1840 in my book on marriage and love, especially chapter 9. The book corroborates the views of Sarsby, Mount, Goody, Pollock, Ingram, Davis, Wrightson and Holbrooke that it is a mistake to believe that affection and love were inventions of the 16th and 17th centuries, let alone the 18th. Two major problems emerge from the overturning of the orthodox view that the romantic love complex was largely invented in the 18th century. One is historiographical. Namely, how did so many historians manage to make such very considerable errors? Various explanations can be mentioned. Firstly, there was the strength of the predictive model. As Shorter and Stone in particular show, the paradigm of a capitalist revolution, later reinforced with industrial, urban, and demographic revolutions, should have led to the situation which they thought they found in the historical materials. If Marx and Weber are right in their timing, then the ideological effects of the Protestant Reformation and capitalist revolution, alongside the rise of a supposed new political and individualistic order, should indeed have been matched by a new family and marriage system whose central pivot was the conjugal unit. The model predicted the revolution in structure and sentiment, and the revolution was duly found. A second reason for error lies in a conflation of evidence from different countries. While most written writers accept, in principle, that the experience of England and that of France, Germany, and other continental countries may have been, and probably was, very different, in practice they tend to overlook this. If we were to put on one side all the evidence from outside England for the moment, then almost all of the proof for the work of Arias, Flandre, Shorter, Stone and others would fall away. Other reasons for error include the taking of material out of context, the jumbling of chronology, false arguments that absence of the expression of emotion means the absence of emotion, deductions about the bulk of the population from the elite, and other logical, technical, and historical errors. Yet in rejecting the revolutionary interpretation of family structure and the neat causal link with rapid changes in the 18th and 19th centuries, we create another problem. We are forced to wonder whether a paradigm that so conspicuously failed to predict what appears to have happened and led to so much error is of much value. We have to question the whole theory of the transition to capitalism and modernity. Furthermore, we are left once again with the problems of trying to explain the causes of the peculiar marriage system. If the romantic love complex was strongly present in the 16th century or earlier in England, we clearly have to reject industrialization and urbanization as causes. It is also clear that the demographic argument, from insecurity to the absence of sentiment, is wrong. This is an important finding. If it had been established that in this case high death rates, constant sickness, and poverty had made love impossible, it might well have been suggested that all our ancestors and all those living in such conditions in the Third World were loveless, brutalized, and without affection. Of course, an enormous amount of anthropological research in tribal and other societies has documented the tenderness of parents towards their children, affection within marriage, and spontaneity and depth of feeling, which is perfectly compatible with high infant and adult mortality and grinding poverty. But all this might have been brushed aside by the supposed dramatic case of the birth of modern society in Europe and North America. As it happens, from the physical and as it happens, however, even this case shows how shallow and naive deductions from the physical and demographic world do not help us to understand the way in which humans think and feel. It now seems certain that the romantic love complex was widespread in England by the 15th century, and probably long before. How are we to explain its presence if we can no longer rely on traditional theories concerning the urban and industrial revolutions and the supposed effects of the rise of capitalism and the Protestant Reformation of the 16th century onwards? One widely accepted theory is that there was a diffusion of a new concept of marriage outwards from southern France. The work of C.S. Lewis, Denis de Rougemont, and more recently Georges Duby has suggested that out of the adulterous philanderings of courtiers, or possibly as a result of a new view of woman that emerged with Catharist heresy, a new sentiment emerged. Thus, C.S. Lewis, in his Allegory of Love, argued that, quote, "French poets in the 11th century discovered or invented or were the first to express that romantic species of passion which English poets were still writing about in the 19th century," end of quote. There are, however, numerous difficulties in using this theory to explain the presence of the romantic love complex in England by the later medieval period. No one, as Lewis admits, has been able to explain satisfactorily why something should have been suddenly invented in 12th century France. The Germanic, Celtic, Byzantine, Classical, Arabic, or Cathar theories are all unsatisfactory in one way or another. This may be because, as Peter Dronker and others have argued, much that was taken by historians and literary critics to be new in the later 11th century is not, in fact, new at all. Furthermore, it is now clear that the portrayal of courtly love as being initially concerned exclusively with extramarital love is incorrect. A further difficulty is to show how the writings of southern French poets concerning the delights of adulterous love in the courtly circles in which they moved can have suddenly inspired millions of ordinary people within a relatively short time to feel a new and overwhelming emotion and alter centuries-old marriage practices. Life may mirror art, but this is rather an extreme case. Accidental literary origins for such a dramatic and powerful peculiarity are unlikely. It seems much more plausible to argue that there were major social, economic, and ideological features of parts of Europe well back into the Middle Ages, which made a certain kind of marriage both possible and desirable. It is an axiom of anthropology that everything is linked to something else, and consequently the ideology of romantic love as the basis for marriage would be part of the whole pattern of kinship and marriage. It will be linked to concepts of the purposes of marriage, the demography of marriage, ideas of the individual, the rules of marriage, and so on. These patterns, in turn, will be linked to the economic, social, political, and religious foundations of a society. In order to explain the origins and persistence of romantic love, we need to show how it was linked to other such institutions. There is something attractive in the suggestion of Marx, Engels, Weber, and their followers that there is some association between the ideology of love marriage and the individualistic and capitalist structure of northern societies. Although the precise link in the 16th to 18th centuries does not fit the observed presence of the ideology, there is an alternative to rejecting the association altogether. If we accept the theory that was dominant between about 1880 and 1940 in England, then the distinctive features which form the background to romantic love were present in England well before the 16th century. As I have argued elsewhere, for example, in my Origins of English Individualism and the Culture of Capitalism, the individualism, market mentality, high mobility, and other features which we associate with capitalism were present in England by at least the start of the 13th century, and perhaps long before. If this is correct, then the evidence concerning love falls into place. It is part of a very ancient system, such a pattern, and the consequence of it. It would seem that there were characteristics of the way in which kinship, religion, law, politics, and economics were organized within the Germanic peoples who conquered Western Europe, which led to a pattern of romantic love and companionate marriage. Such a pattern never died out in England, whereas in much of Europe it was largely submerged by old and renovated features of the preceding Roman civilization. Being an island, one of the few areas which almost totally rejected Roman language, law, religion, England harbored a peculiar ethic of romantic love, which had been more spread earlier. Symbolically, the word love itself is Anglo-Saxon. Thus, the ultimate origins are probably cultural and thousands of years old. Here I'd like to end by briefly sketching a few of the ways which such an ideology fitted functionally with some of the other parts of the society. One important component was Christianity. As Jack Goody has argued, the distinctive pattern of Christian marriage was early established, the basic features being present by the 9th century. This was a religion that enjoined celibacy, monogamy, a freedom of choice in marriage, and a severe sexual code prohibiting sexual relations before and outside marriage. Such a formal marriage regime, enjoined by the dominant religious system, was an ideal background for that peculiar romantic love ideology, which combined frustration, eroticism, and desire. The ideals of celibacy, the late age at marriage, the battle between biological desire and religious injunctions are clearly a part of the pattern of romantic love. Passion was herded into marriage. Sex and marriage were synonymous in a way that is unusual in world civilizations. Biological urges were channeled, sublimated, and hence coloured the world. These special features were present in Western Europe many centuries before the Protestant Reformation. Romantic love also fitted with the kinship system. Talcott Parsons, the sociologist, when comparing the kinship system of the United States with more kinship-dominated societies, suggested that the, quote, structural isolation of the conjugal family tends to free the affective inclinations of the couple from a whole series of hampering restrictions, end of quote. In closely knit, interdependent, kinship-based societies, any considerable range of affective spontaneity would tend to impinge on the statuses and interests of too many others, with disequilibrating consequences for the system as a whole. End of quote. When wider kinship is strong, marriages are arranged and affection between husband and wife. As Stjoberg has written, quote, romantic love is, of all things, an expression of individualism, and as such it is at variance with the maintenance of a well-integrated, extended kinship unit, end of quote. Hence, sociologists have linked the rise of individual love marriage to the degree of involvement of the conjugal family in wider kin ties and set of obligations to parents after death. That's from W.J. Good's book on the family. We now know that the cognatic kinship system, which isolates out the husband and wife in terminology and residence, was present in England from Anglo-Saxon times onwards. There is little evidence that wider kinship groupings were important in everyday life among the mass of the population. Romantic love was an appropriate ideology which could both flourish and hold together this individualistic system. The cohesive importance of romantic love in a society where formal kinship is weak can be explored a little further. If kinship groups do not arrange marriage, why marry at all? One reason for marrying, we have already seen, was that the ethical and social system was such that to have sexual relations outside marriage was considered a serious offence. As Thomas More in the early 16th century pointed out in his Utopia, premarital sex should be harshly punished for, quote, very few people would want to get married if they weren't carefully prevented from having any sexual intercourse otherwise, end of quote. This links up with the frustration theory and has been repeated in other words by Robert Brain, who writes that perhaps without the passion of romantic love, romantic loving, or its stimulation, along with the withholding of sexual access until after marriage, people might not marry at all. There is a second theory introduced here, namely that the passion of romantic love binds people together in long-term associations which would otherwise not occur. This has been suggested in different words by Greenfield, the sociologist, quote, rational, profit-seeking individuals would never marry at all, except for the instituted irrationality, that's in inverted commas within the quote, instituted irrationality of romantic love. A sociobiologist might therefore see romantic love as a necessary drive to ensure the survival of the human race at a level above mere short-term sexual couplings. The romantic love ideology may be seen as appropriate, even necessary, in a society where the external pressures on permanent unions through kinship are largely absent. The intense emotion of love can also be seen as culturally induced or exaggerated by the religious and social ideology which equates sexual and marital relations. We can take these elective affinities, to use Max Weber's term, further by looking at the way in which such an ideology seems entirely appropriate, in a paradoxical way, for a capitalistic and individualistic society. Even the apparent paradoxes support the association. The greatest of these has been noted by Greenfield, that between the supposed rationality of capitalism and the irrationality of love. This has been resolved by Max Weber, who delicately shows how it is not merely that frustration creates the passion of love, but that passion is sustained by the loneliness and alienation created by this particular form of society. Weber showed that the central emotional features of love is a necessity where capitalist economic structures have developed most fully. At first sight, sexual passion and love seem to be totally at variance with what is needed by capitalism. Weber observed that being one of the strongest non-rational factors in human life, sexual drives are, quote, one of the strongest potential menaces to the individual's rational pursuit of economic ends. Yet by a subtle shift, love and sex were domesticated. The force was channeled and love became one of the central dynamic elements in the capitalist system. Romantic love is, of course, possible and present outside capitalism, but only in capitalist or capitalist-influenced societies is it made the cultural pivot of the ideology. Weber saw that as societies became more bureaucratic and rational, so at the heart of the system there grew an impulsive, irrational and non-capitalist emotion at the level of the individual. We can see the same paradox in the treatment of the natural world. As things become more orderly, a desire for disorderliness and wildness grows. As the world is conquered by money and calculations of profit and loss, certain areas become reserved as totally outside any calculation based on profit. So it is with the growing desire for the totally overwhelming, irrational escape into romantic love. Just as he had caught the paradox of otherworldly mysticism leading to capitalist accumulation, so Weber hints at the way in which love marriage lies at the heart of rational capitalism. I quote, "The erotic relation seems to offer the unsurpassable peak of the fulfillment of the request for love in the direct fusion of the souls of one to the other. This boundless giving of oneself is as radical as possible in its opposition to all functionality, rationality, and generality. It is displayed as the unique meaning which one creature in his irrationality has for another, and only for this specific other. The lover knows himself to be freed from the cold, skeleton hands of rational orders, just as completely as from the banality of everyday routine." Romantic love gives meaning in an otherwise dead and cold world. It promises that fusion with another human being, which is so conspicuously lacking in the lonely crowds of autonomous individuals. It overcomes separation and gives the endlessly choice-making individual a rest, a categorical which resolves all the doubts and indecisions. Furthermore, the emotion of desire to have, to own, to possess fits very well with those similarly irrational drives to accumulate, possess, and own, which are the basic drive in the economic sphere. In the modern world, it is obvious how consumer society has harnessed the romantic love complex to sell goods, and how its enormous emphasis has raised love to a high cultural pinnacle. Love provides the promise of freedom, meaning, and a return to the Garden of Eden before the fall.